topic session number 19922, Reel 3.
Barry Smith, Reel 3. You were just telling me about how you kept on in Korea.
Oh, yes. Right. I hope I got the picking up from where I went before. Yes. Well, when we went, after it's addressed by the officers and what have you, I think we were moved up the line by train, terrible trains, so much so that you couldn't sleep in them if you were travelling by night. I slept on just laying on the floor. They're just old American trains, military trains, and that is where through a much unusual land. It seemed very barren. In that, I understand it's a very green country now, but at that time it looked like parched, badly knocked about. Refugees on the road, things totally alien to our culture. Anyway, the battalion was shipped up by train and they stopped to refuel, I think, at one junction. And early hours in the morning, and it was the first experience I have of seeing cruelty. Because it's totally alien to British soldiers to witness things like that. They get very uptight about it sort of thing. And I'll tell you for why in a minute. There's always those in a regiment visiting that will be very forthcoming. And they'll take immediate action, you know, in that sense. You know, I used to call the hardened cases of a regiment those that were a bit more strident than others. We stopped at this junction and I threw the windows open. And there was a little boy there. With all he had was a sack for the bottom, with two for his legs, and a sack on the top, tied up a string in the middle. And he was trying to sell us apples. The next thing I knew is this South Korean, I might add, South Korean guard came along, obviously Oriental looking. We, of course, at that time, we thought we were fighting mates of North Koreans, but in actual fact, it was the Chinese, as you know. But you could tell one Chinese from another, or Oriental looking. And this, he must have been a junction guard or something like that. And next thing he knew was he was starting to hit this little boy with his rifle, pushing around like, you not sow apples, sort of thing. All hell let loose because the fellas on the train didn't like this, see this. They were going to get off the train and they were going to really get hold of this fella and give him a go at going over. This didn't come into fruition because all of a sudden round the corner came this American army jeep in the American military police and the situation was diffused. After they got hold of this guard and told him sort of what have you, but they obviously must have been in the area because they wouldn't have been at hand. But I mean, that was my first experience of seeing cruelty, maybe not against the enemy, but what you witness in a wartime situation. That was my first experience. The next experience was after a terribly tiring journey. We were sent, I think it was Camp Casey. You may have heard this name before. I think it was Camp Casey. And immediately we were put into training again. And we were given, we'd already had all these various injections, but I think we were given other injections against malaria and taught how to use paludrine tablets, which was anti-malaria tablets that were given at that time. And we were schooled in all the various things that you would have to contend with while being in the line. Water couldn't be drunk. Water could only be drunk that was shipped up to you. If you did use any water, you had to use the tablets that would render it clear. But in actual fact, we didn't drink any of the water out, they said, because in all the streams that ran through Korea at that time. Dead animals' bodies were lying in them, may have laid them. They were contaminated. Cholera was rife. So you didn't, was told not to partake any of, you know, I mean, some city sod were going, get on a can, drink out of a brook, and he'd be down. Because so the British Army, as you know, were quite rigorous in making sure that no one was going to be a city fool and go down with something and not look after himself. In other words, almost a chargeable offence if you make a fool of yourself and go and drink the water. You know, he's rendered, they've got a soldier who now can't, he's not combat ready. You've got, in other words, the climate has beaten him. The British Army are aware of this, and I think they always have been since time immemorial. But then we went on training, and we were in under canvas, American canvas tents, and very, very hot, if I remember rightly, sweltering. Several fellows, I remember one of our crowd, he went down with heat stroke and had to be sent back to base. Heat stroke in a true sense of the word. Mosquitoes were rife. We were given mosquito nets, and they were, mosquitoes were everywhere. I didn't feel at all well at one time, because they gave us these, I don't know what they were giving us, something to prevent malaria, but it made you feel like you had flu. But in actual fact, I don't think you had flu. It was just part of the the reaction to the drugs we were given. Also, we were put on training as a signals headquarters company. They had some, as you know, in Korea, some pretty ominous hills and pretty rough countryside, to say the least, and very rugged. And the sergeant would, whoever in charge of us at that time, would get us in full battle order. That is, that you'd wear if you were actually on an attack or patrol or what have you, and plus your full radio set in the case of a signaller. So I was not only carrying full battle order, but I had a 31 set as well. And that's all your ammunition, the lot. And they would run you up and down these hills at least three times before you were allowed to have breakfast. Now, you probably thought this is a cruel thing to do, and you've heard about these things, they've done them in the British Army, but the idea was is that they felt that once you get in the line and you couldn't run up and down a hill with full equipment, you were a goner, because if you lagged behind, you'd be picked off or you're no use to your colleagues. So it's one way they sort the wheat from the chaff, I suppose. Now, I was only very fit. I've always been a sportsman in my family. That average build. But I found it very hard, to say the least. Absolutely. Well, can't explain it. But I think being a sportsman carried me through. And I think, well, I'm not going to let it beat me. I've got to try and keep up with the others. There were fellows much heavier built than myself that would go by the roadside. The conditions were such that they couldn't cope with them. And I think if you're lighter built, heat and cold probably is something that you can contend with more than someone who's very heavily built or what have you, or very tall, what have you, sort of thing. And we did the training, I remember vividly, proper battle training then, because we were constantly on training. What periods this lasted, I can't recall, but other fusiliers and the regiment will tell you if you go to the archives. We did training at night, especially at night, and force marches and what have you, as you would do in a proper attack situation, with my full equipment, as I just explained, digging in all the time and what have you. Seemed to be sort of damn stupid, because the ground was so hard and even impossible in the winter. But the worst part was when the monsoons came, and the training in the wet weather, with especially with mosquitoes, humming about at night time. It was pretty horrible, to say the least. But you were one of many, so you just had to get on with it. Or I say you just hoped that you get through all this and get home safe to your own country. You didn't know what was in store for you, because they didn't always tell you what was going to happen until they actually knew themselves, I suppose. Well, eventually we shipped up and we took over from the King's Own Scottish Borders, I think. What you would do, you'd be shipped up at night. As a signaller then, I was then transferred to a company. That'd be two of us, maybe three if you were lucky. Two of us to a company, and you would be immediately working with the officers who were in command in that company. You'd be their signaller. You went up with the radio jeeps and what have you. There's a certain amount of animosity you get in the regiment, where they say to signallers, they've got a lovely cushy job, they sit in a radio car and what have you, and here we are, we're down the trenches and what have you. Nothing could be further from the truth, because, and I'll explain this as I go on, as a signaller, you're constantly busy, constantly. And in fact, this is why I think I'm probably lucky to get through it in a way. And one of the things I found is that because you're a signaller, there's only a few of you, and you're all seconded out to various companies from headquarter company, you had a responsible job, and you were constantly doing jobs like charging batteries, laying lines, communication, etc. And you got very little time to sleep. Whereas an ordinary squaddie may have had his time, we were sleep. But then if you wanted, you doubled up and you didn't get any sleep. And I can remember on many occasions I would get no sleep for 3 nights. I couldn't do it now. If you did sleep, you catnapped. And certainly you would never catnap over a radio. It was a court-martial offence. To go to sleep over a radio in any situation through exhaustion was you would be court-martialed on the spot. That responsible job too. You must always be on there if anyone calls you for help, patrol, or whether you're out on patrol yourself. It sounds like an exaggeration, but it's not an exaggeration. If you're not a signaller, it's very difficult for another person to be able to relate to the responsibilities of that. I wouldn't say my job was any more responsible than an ordinary rifleman. Only, as I've explained from my previous things I've said, you felt that you were responsible and you had to do your job the best. And if you didn't, all hell, the ton of bricks come down on you. So the officers expected you to be on the ball and to have an answer straight away. This was expected, and as I say, this is why I emphasise the fact that you were so highly trained with the equipment we had at that time, not what they've got today. The training we had was a godsend, because without it, you would have been at odds. You couldn't have managed. You wouldn't have known. You'd have panicked or something along those lines. You would have been. You wouldn't have made a good job of it, and you would have been. You wouldn't have been any good to your colleagues either. At any rate, we were moved up, the convoy were marched up from, I don't know how many miles back, 10 or 20 miles back, marched up under cover of darkness, and we were filtered into the trenches in the front line while the other regiment filtered out. This is common practice. And as if you want to know, the regiments that we took over from or all the events that took place. It's all in the National Royal Fusiliers archives. It's all there. You can read it in.
That's all right. Just suit your own story. Yeah. That's all right.
Yeah. And then, as I say, it was a strange environment. You were in these on these hills, barbed wire, dugouts, some of them very deep. The bunkers, something like 20 feet deep, with girders and heavy girders over the top. On the top of that, they used to have tanks, believe it or not. We should attract more fire than they used to send out, so we used to say, because they were a tank. And we would be in similar bunkers along the trenches. Some of them were reminiscent of the 1418 war. Very reminiscent, if you can compare it to that. Some people have said it's like that. A lot of people said of the period that I was there that it was what they called a static war. I wouldn't have described it as a static war in my opinion, because as I said, we were, for example, apart from maintaining the signals in the command post for the officer and charging all the batteries, we were then had to stand to as a normal infantryman on the when the first light, when a lot of the Chinese attacks would take place, or during the hours of darkness. We would, two of us would take it in turns. We would do, say, like 3 or 4 hours on, 4 hours off, and you just sleep when you could. And it was like that. You slept where you could. If they wanted 2 signals on, you were on whether you had to sleep or not. And then you had to go out and replace lines. This was done in the day and night. But on the forward positions, we would go out and repair lines to the in the minefield. To at the end of the minefields, right out in no man's land, they would have a standing patrol, which would go out in darkness and stay there till first light. And they used to just sit there and listen for enemy movement. And they had a line to them, and it was constantly being blown by shellfire. You may have had this from other Korean veterans, that at that time of the war, one of the things is that the shellfire became heavier than any other time during the war. So they say, I'm not certain about this, but certainly my first experience going about my normal job on the hill, as a signaller is doing, replacing lines, charging batteries, working the radio transmitters, doing the normal call-ups by the brigade, because you had to keep control of the headquarters company, you're all responsible for that. All the codes and messages that come through, you'll be responsible for that, and decoding them to the officers. We had, now, of course, it's not bound by the Official Secrets Act, now, on this one, but we had a code called Schematic, which is, you know, like the German Enigma code. And it was nothing more or less than they'd have a word which represented another word. So you say cat would mean, say, like a word like movement. And someone would come up with an archaic message, like a message follows, there's cat in reference so-and-so and so-and-so, or something like that. This would then be decoded by us. It would mean Chinese movement, so-and-so. It was a silly sort of speech in free language, which we used, because though we were trained in Morse, it was found that it really wasn't quick enough for battle action. Officers like to talk directly to the situation. If you had a Morse, you'd have to decode it all and God knows what else. Morse, of course, is really for long distance communications, because it travels further than the spoken word. As regards my first experience of enemy fire, was mortars used to come over. Some of them were silent, some of them you could hear. The silent ones were the ones that was the most terrifying, in that you could just get an explosion as opposed to any... You probably might hear the last fizz of it coming in, but my ears must have been better then than the silent, than the ordinary ones, which you'd hear coming in anyhow. You get the artillery shells, and also quite a bit of heavy shelling. And we'd shell them, and they'd shell us, and they'd obviously pick a target and have a go at us, and we would retaliate, and the tanks would fire. They had given ranges of fire as well. They'd have machine guns at night, would have a range of fire, and they'd fire to a certain point and then move. And it's really to keep the Chinese heads down in that sense. Set fire patterns. All I'm telling you is probably something you'll probably already know, or it's already documented. Anyway, my own personal experience was one of the first shells that came over, and this is not, well, as you call it, funny. Our latrines were nothing more or less than a hole dug in a trench with a bit of wood across, and you did what you had to and got out of it. You know, yeah, there's always at the rear of the hills, because the Chinese artillery had a lot of them. They used to dig tunnels and put the guns through the front of the hill, so they were point blank at you. I can tell you about this later. As a signaller, I'd get to know these things, because the artillery spotters, who incidentally at that time was the 16th New Zealand Artillery, they were responsible for saving most of the company at the Battle of Pimlico, and I'd expound on this later. One of the first mortars that came over, a shell and mortar, went straight down the latrines. With the obvious results, everything went everywhere. But the part that I thought was funny was that you could have been sitting there. Well, if you're sitting there, you wouldn't have known all about it anyhow. But then after a while, you got used to this. You'd hear them coming in, and you get your head down. And if you were out laying a line to lines that were constantly being broken, there was lines everywhere. It was difficult to find which was yours. And if you couldn't ring back and find which line was operable, out of the ones that had been severed, just ran out a new line. You were supposed to, on line laying parties, to have a guard. But in practice, this never worked out, because we used to go out and just ones or two of us, to lay lines, or where it was only one was required, he'd go out and he'd just lay a new line out to the other section, and then test it and discard those that were no good. The landscape at that time was wires everywhere and trees shattered and a real mess, and it bears no resemblance to the hills that are green now, I understand. People that have been back, I haven't, but very strange environment, really. And one felt very, very, isolated, very strange. So I suppose you felt, well, as long as we can get through this and get home, that's all that really matters, you know. You know, I hope I'm afraid of God to get through it, you know. Anyway, when it comes to actual battle tactics or going out in the line, quite regularly we would go out into the minefield. That is, we'd go through over the barbed wire, through the mine gaps. A lot of these were already, the mines, the trip wires, were already primed with grenades. And these grenades would hang on the line, and on one occasion I was out, always done in the darkness, and I straddled this wire, and it was got grenades, and of course you can imagine my feelings when he said to me, quietly, phosphorus, you know, and they gradually picked our way down through the minefield, And when we are out 99s, so carry on about the subject of laying lines out through the mind gaps and to other companies. We've been taught, this is just sidetracking, we've been taught in Germany, where we were trained, to repair lines. We were told that this is what would require us in a battle situation. Most battle situations or manoeuvres are always done at night, invariably at night, for obvious reasons. We would repair lines blindfolded with our hands behind our backs. We got so good at it, splitting the various cables, that we're able to do this faultlessly. Sheridan, our sergeant major, sergeant in control of the signals section in Iserlohn, was a hard man, determined to make us very proficient in radio and lines, and all the other signals work. This came in, we didn't realise it at the time, but this came in great attribute when you, to be well trained like that, when you actually are in the dark and doing it for real. We would run our hands along the lines, feeling for a break. This was done by in the mind gaps and to other companies. We invariably either worked in ones or twos. If you were out in the minefield, you'd be quite heavily armed with Sten, selection of magazines. You hadn't got time to reload if you bumped into a Chinese patrol, which is quite possible even in your own mind gap. And in fact, did happen to us on a number of occasions. You carry a selection of grenades and your equipment. This brings me to one particular, I'll digress now. One particular occasion, we were, this line which was out to, that passed out to the standing patrol or listening patrol. The listening patrol was sent out under at first darkness, out into the middle of the minefield at the mine gap, and it would lay up there, about half a dozen of them, say, lay up there listening for enemy movement. They were then they used a landline only when necessary to advise us that they were in position or leaving or not. They'd only use it then if there was anything to report. It was done in complete silence, as it were. If this went down, they were out of communication. So if it was blown, we had to go out and repair it. The officers would take over the radios or another signaler. If we had another signal, we normally only had about two on a company. Pretty sparse in manning in those days compared to the Chinese, I believe, who had twice as many men to ours on their positions. Yeah. To sidetrack, as it were, because I'm going from one subject to another, so I can get this of interest to you. We were out on one occasion, my colleague and I, and we're making our way along the ridge over the paddy fields, over the mine gap. And all of a sudden, he disappeared. And I thought, what the hell was going on here? And there wasn't a lot of noise. We were had to work in complete silence. We didn't sort of have conversations out there. Because it could sound at night carries, as you know. And the next thing I knew,